From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Iraqgate. Did the Bush administration's pro-Iraqi policies help lead to the Gulf War? And did the administration try to cover up policy blunders? We'll talk with Douglas Franz, who spent most of the past year investigating the story for the LA Times. Also today, the true story of the Three Little Pigs. We talk with John Sheska and Lane Smith about retelling some famous fairy tales. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers the woman behind the legendary Scepter record label. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The three major candidates for vice president have taken the stage in Atlanta for their 90-minute broadcast debate. This debate is the only one scheduled for the running mates. In tonight's format, a single moderator, ABC TV's Hal Bruno, will direct questions to Vice President Dan Quayle, Democrat Al Gore, and Independent James Stockdale. Gore and Quayle have each been preparing for the confrontation in mock debates with their aides. Stockdale says he's prepared by talking with his colleagues at the Hoover Institution, where he's a senior fellow. Bill Clinton is in Williamsburg, Virginia today, resting his voice and preparing for the second presidential debate to be held in Richmond on Thursday. NPR's Mara Liasson prepared this report.
Bill Clinton arrived in Colonial Williamsburg to a tumultuous welcome today from tourists and supporters. He pantomimed his way through the crowd. Clinton will spend the next day and a half nursing his hoarse voice and preparing for Thursday's debate. Clinton is suffering from a combination of allergies and an infection of his vocal cords. His aides say Clinton should do well in Thursday's debate, however. The format combines questions from a single moderator with questions from a live audience. Clinton's aides say that the Arkansas Democrat has fielded thousands of similar questions from live audiences throughout the campaign, and that gives him an advantage. In Williamsburg, I'm Mara Liasson.
The chairman of the House Banking Committee called today for the resignation of Attorney General William Barr. Representative Henry Gonzalez charged that Barr has undermined the integrity of the Justice Department by impeding investigations. The Texas Democrat said that his banking committee has spent 2 years investigating what he says are about $4 billion in illegal loans to Iraq through a branch bank in Atlanta. Gonzalez said that Barr had delayed indictments in the case and refused to appoint an independent counsel. An Iranian newspaper reports that Lebanon's Muslim fundamentalist Hezbollah organization has offered to exchange two Israeli soldiers for Muslims held in Israeli prisons. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
According to the Resalat newspaper published in Tehran, Hezbollah says it has been holding two Israeli soldiers who went missing in 1986. Hezbollah leader Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, who was on a 10-day visit to Iran, was quoted as saying he would exchange the two soldiers for an unspecified number of Muslim prisoners in Israeli jails. Nasrallah said neither of the two Israelis was a pilot, which ruled out a deal for Air Force navigator Ron Arad. Israeli officials had no comment on the report, but of six missing Israeli soldiers, only Arad is widely believed to still be alive. In the past, Israel has traded large numbers of Arab prisoners for several Israeli soldiers or their bodies. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The State Department said today that Bosnian Serbs are ignoring the UN Security Council's ban on combat flights over Bosnia. Spokesman Joe Snyder said the United States is consulting with its allies on ways to enforce the ban, including pushing for a new and tougher UN resolution. Snyder said that Bosnian Serbs flew many sorties, including bombing raids, against a government-held city on Saturday. He said the Serbs didn't fly any combat missions on Sunday or Monday, but that Serbian warplanes are operating again today. The so-called no-fly zone resolution was passed on Friday and took effect immediately. A new survey says the cost of going to college is up significantly this year. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
It costs $2,315 to attend an average four-year public college this year, 10% more than it did last year and 23% more than in 1990. The College Board, an association of 2,800 schools and agencies, reported today that the $210 increase in tuition is significant because there's been a consistent drop in student financial aid. Students attending private four-year colleges also had to pay more. Private school tuition, on average, stands at about $10,498, 7% more this year than last year. The survey found cost increases in almost everything: dormitory and housing fees, books, school supplies, and transportation. College officials reportedly expected much larger increases because of the nation's sluggish economy, but there's no indication that the cost of a college education will drop or level off in the near future. I'm Claudia Sanchez in Washington.
Stock prices closed sharply higher today on Wall Street in response to unexpectedly good earnings reports from some major corporations. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 27 points to close at 3,201. Advances led declines by a margin of about 10 to 7 in active trading of about 184 million shares. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. President Bush's greatest period of popularity resulted from his leadership during the Gulf War, and he has pointed to his foreign policy skills as one of his greatest assets. Now, newly uncovered secret documents reveal the Bush administration pursued a pro-Iraq policy before the war, in spite of warnings that Iraq was building an arsenal of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. The latest development in this story shows the Bush administration may have tried to cover up policy blunders by withholding documents requested in an investigation of bank loans to Iraq. My guest, Douglas Franz, is one of the first reporters to write about the so-called Iraqgate story. He's been investigating the story for close to a year for the Los Angeles Times, often working with reporter Murray Wass. We invited Franz to bring us up to date on the story. In an interview earlier today, I asked who was warning the Bush administration about Iraq's growing arsenal.
Virtually anyone who was watching Iraq from an intelligence perspective was warning. The first warnings actually came in late January of 1989, when this was just a brand new administration, and intelligence officials briefed congressional committees on background about Libya initially, but they also raised alarms in January of 89 about Iraq's ambitious nuclear weapons program. And from that period forward, Terry, the intelligence warnings flowed fairly regularly from the Central Intelligence Agency, from the Defense Intelligence Agency at the Pentagon, from State Department intelligence sources, from the Energy Department here, where as early as April of 1989, U.S. companies complained to the Energy Department that Iraqi agents were trying to buy nuclear weapons technology from U.S. firms. And that litany or series of warnings continued unabated and basically ignored by the Bush administration.
And we know this because of secret documents that have been released?
Yes. I mean, some of them have been released. Others have been secured and written about by Murray Wass and I in the Los Angeles Times. But these are the administration's own words. I think that's why it's been so difficult for them to confront this story, because what our stories have been based on, and most stories in other newspapers have been based on, are the administration's own internal documents. These warnings have been written about extensively now, and it's very difficult to counter them. The administration's sort of line of defense in the last couple of weeks has been that the warnings were few and thin, and they really weren't worth jeopardizing our limited, they say, relationship with Iraq.
Who was advising the president to proceed in this tilt toward Iraq, while others were advising not to?
Well, I think the primary players who were advising the president were Secretary of State James Baker. We've seen his name on numerous memos. He got these warnings, the intelligence warnings from the CIA and the DIA and the Energy Department, and yet he continued to push this pro-Iraq policy. And also members of the National Security Council staff at the White House. That's the organization that really provides coordinated national security and foreign policy advice to the president, and they were pushing very hard to continue this pro-Iraq tilt. Their explanation is now that they were helping Saddam in a moderate way in an attempt to bring him into, as the president says, the family of nations.
So on the one hand, you have some people advising the president to continue this pro-Iraq policy, while others warned that Iraq was building its chemical, nuclear, biological arsenal. What were the reasons for strengthening the policy with Iraq?
Well, for expanding the ties, the President Bush has explained on several occasions when he's been forced to confront questions stemming from this foreign policy issue. He said that we did it to try and bring Saddam Hussein into the family of nations. We were trying to moderate his behavior by offering limited economic incentives and selling him limited amounts of high technology. In fact, I think what the documents have shown that have emerged over the last several months, Terry, is that this was more than limited economic aid. We sent over $5 billion worth of loan guarantees to Iraq between 1983 and 1990, which freed up another $5 billion in hard Iraqi currency so they could spend it on the weapons programs. We've seen evidence, not proof yet, but evidence that some of that, those loan guarantees, which were to buy American food products, in fact, were used by Iraq to buy weapons. So I think it's difficult to cast that as a limited policy. We've also seen many other instances where U.S. technology, given granted export licenses by the Bush administration and earlier the Reagan administration, were used by Iraq in its efforts to develop chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, and ballistic missiles to deliver them.
I want to get back to these loan guarantees a little bit later. There was a memo to James Baker in 1989 from the CIA warning about Iraq's advancing nuclear missile programs. After that memo to Baker, President Bush signed a top-secret order mandating closer economic and political relations with Baghdad. Can we assume President Bush knew about that memo, or is that still in question?
That's a really interesting question. I think the extent of President Bush's knowledge at the moment he signed National Security Directive 26 is still a matter that needs to be sorted out. Murray Wass and I have followed the trail of these intelligence memos. We've seen distribution lists, and we've been told who saw them, and we follow the trail, and it stops right outside the Oval Office. Now, that's not necessarily unusual. You know, what is unusual, I guess, is that we've been able to track this material that far. But, you know, it's unclear at this point what the president knew when he signed that. It is very clear what James Baker knew about Iraq's attempts to build nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction at the time he advised the president to sign that order. And that order is a very important, in fact, a crucial juncture in U.S.-Iraq relations, because when it was issued on October 2, 1989, there was a great debate within the administration over continuing these loan guarantees that we're discussing. The Italian bank in Atlanta had been discovered to be loaning $5 billion to Iraq in hidden illegal loans, some of that guaranteed by the United States government. There were questions about Iraqi involvement in irregularities. There was a big movement to stop the sending that money over to Iraq because of these suspicions of irregularities. But NSD 26 was the broom that swept aside all of those objections. It was cited on numerous times by Baker and the NSC and the other State Department officials to override objections to continuing this aid to Iraq. And in fact, NSD became the broom that swept aside all those problems.
You say that the most damning memo that has recently come to light was written by President Bush just days before Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. And this was a memo from Bush to Saddam Hussein. And he wrote, "Let me reassure you that my administration continues to desire better relations with Iraq. We will also continue to support our other friends in the region." How does this revise the Gulf War story?
Well, I think this requires a major revision. If you'll remember, Terry, or if your listeners will remember, shortly after the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, Iraq-ish released a transcript of a conversation between Saddam Hussein and April Glaspie, who had been the U.S. ambassador to Iraq. That conversation was on July 25th, 1990, and in that conversation, April Glaspie delivered a very sort of weak warning to Saddam, and she was criticized enormously in Congress for not strongly and bluntly telling Hussein that he better not go into Kuwait or the United States would come down with him with the full weight of its military might. In fact, what we see in this secret cable from President Bush directly to Saddam Hussein, written 3 days later, is that President Bush adopted the very same attitude. It was a measure of cautious warning, coupled with a measure of very obvious appeasement. Again, let me assure you, as you read, that we desire better relations with Iraq, and we will continue, however, to support our friends. At that time, there were 35,000 Iraqi troops massed on the border of Kuwait. It was a fairly obvious military threat. And nowhere in that two-page cable from Bush to Hussein is the word Kuwait even mentioned.
My guest is Douglas Franz, who's been investigating the Iraqgate story for the Los Angeles Times. Our interview was recorded earlier today. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Douglas Franz. He's an investigative reporter for the Los Angeles Times, where he's been covering the so-called Iraqgate story for the past year, and he has broken many parts of this story and was probably the first reporter on it. Let's look at some of the latest developments in this story, which you've already touched on, but let's flesh this out. The Senate Intelligence Committee is now investigating illegal loans to Iraq that were made by a bank branch in America in the years before the war. The loans were made by the Atlanta branch of an Italian bank. What were the loans and why were they illegal?
Well, that's a good question. This is a most confusing and
murky
affair.
Yeah, it sure
affair.
Is. Yeah.
The bank is Italy's largest bank. It's Banca Nazionale del Lavoro. It's owned by the Italian government. And between 1985 and 1989, the tiny Atlanta branch of this bank made $5 billion worth of loans to Iraq. The U.S. government, in indicting six employees of the Atlanta branch, said that they were solely responsible for those loans, and they were masterminded by Chris Dragul, the branch manager down there, without the knowledge of bank officials in Rome and without reporting them as required to U.S. and Georgia banking regulators. That's what makes them illegal. What makes them illicit, if you will, is that a lot of those loans, it turns out, were used to buy specific weapons and weapons technology to build up Iraq's military arsenal before the war. For instance, in April of 1989, Christopher Dragul was in Baghdad visiting his customers, and he toured a weapons plant where he was shown Scud missiles that were being enhanced, and he was told, see, this is what your loans are helping us do.
Now, the CIA withheld documents about these bank loans, and the CIA says that the Justice Department asked the CIA to withhold the documents. So now there's a big feud between the CIA and the Justice Department about who did what. What were the documents?
The documents, as far as I know, were four cables from the CIA station chief in Rome back to the agency headquarters in Langley, in which the station chief quoted four separate generally reliable sources, as this was in September and October of 1989, saying that BNL Rome officials were aware of the Atlanta loan activity when it was going on. Now, these cables are important, Terry, because they go very in an opposite direction from the government's case. The U.S. government case says that this activity was contained in Atlanta, unknown to BNL officials in Rome. What these cables do is raise strong suspicions that, in fact, BNL officials in Rome were aware of this activity. If they were aware of that activity, it does two things. One, it removes a large part of the government's indictment of these Atlanta officials, because much of that indictment claims that they defrauded their home office bank. Now, they can't defraud a bank if the bank was aware of the loans. But second, if this trail had been followed up into the upper reaches of BNL Rome, it would have been politically embarrassing for the Italian government, And one of the theories is that had the Italian government been embarrassed, they might in turn have attacked the Bush administration by saying, we were just following the Bush administration's orders to help Iraq here. This was another wink and a nod policy of the Bush administration. Now, there's not much proof for that last theory, Terry, although we've quoted numerous State Department cables which show that the Italian ambassador to the United States and BNL Bank officials from Rome applied enormous pressure on the State Department and the Justice Department to restrict this investigation and keep it from going at Rome. And in fact, they didn't go at Rome. It emerged during Dragoole's three-week sentencing hearing down in Atlanta last month that the investigators were blocked by the Justice Department when they wanted to go to Rome and view documents there and interview officials there.
Let me say that I know this is an incredibly complicated story to follow, so let me ask you to just sum up what you think the importance is of these revelations of the past couple of weeks about the bank loans and the CIA documents and so on. How important a development is this?
I think that the significance of this dispute between the CIA and the Justice Department is that it illustrates, again, that the Bush administration policy was to help Iraq during this very critical period, and it raises the strong possibility that the U.S. government turned the other way in order to shield that policy. I think that's the most important thing. The second thing that the fact that these documents were withheld does is that it lends credence to the theory that there was an administration-wide cover-up of the extent of its aid here. Now, the BNL case and the investigation of it, Murray and I had already written back in March of 1992, had been delayed by the Justice Department. Defendants had been removed at the request of the State Department. So it was the New York Times that broke the story that the White House had called the prosecutor involved in this investigation at the very beginning of the investigation. So we already saw a level of interference from the Bush administration. The withholding of these documents raises the ante considerably because it shows that there was a possibility of a cover-up here.
Let's look at how this may or may not affect the presidential election. I mean, the president really is campaigning on his foreign policy expertise. How do these revelations affect what Bush is saying about his foreign policy?
Well, this issue is still sort of smoldering as a campaign issue. The Democrats have been slow to pick it up. By Democrats, I mean Clinton and Gore. Democrats in Congress, led by Henry Gonzalez, have been raising the issue for many weeks now, many months. But the Clinton-Gore campaign has been slow to pick it up. But I think that nonetheless, the issue has already had a big impact on the presidential race because what it has done is neutralized the positive benefits of the Gulf War for George Bush. Whenever his campaign wants to raise the specter of that victory to show him as a savvy foreign policy manager, they know they're going to have to confront these questions about the role of the United States and particularly the role of President Bush in assisting Saddam Hussein in the military buildup. That, I think, goes to the heart of why I say this in the story in the LA Times today, why this July 28, 1990 cable from Bush to Hussein is important, because I think it shows that at that time, Bush was still in a conciliatory stance towards Saddam. And if you look at that 5 days before the war, 5 days before he began calling him Adolf Hitler, that raises real questions about just how savvy a political leader George Bush is in foreign affairs, I think.
Al Gore has charged that President Bush's policies actually led to the Gulf War, and Clinton has called for the appointment of an independent counsel to investigate whether the administration has covered up its pre-war dealings with Iraq. And yet you really haven't heard the Democrats talking about the story all that much. Why do you think that they're not making more of an issue out of it during this campaign?
Well, I'm not sure. There have been certainly staffers in the Clinton-Gore campaign. There have been staffers at DNC who've been very interested in this issue, and they've tried to push it at the campaign. I think for one thing, Gore is better positioned to raise this issue than Clinton, because Gore in the Senate voted to authorize the use of military force. He's a member of the Armed Services Committee. So in a sense, he's got the standing to do it. If Clinton does it, he risks Bush coming back and accusing him of being wishy-washy on the war because of those sort of either-or statements that Clinton has made about the war in the last few months. That may have made them a little shy. They may just be, they may think that this is too complicated an issue. They've certainly hammered away at jobs and the economy, and maybe they just think this issue is too complicated for the voters to understand.
President Bush said that his pro-Iraq policy was to try to bring Iraq into the family of nations. Might there have been other reasons, too, pertaining to oil or other economic reasons?
Well, we've seen evidence that there were other considerations. Whether they rose to reasons or not, I'm not sure. One of the most interesting memos that we've written about was a March 29, 1989 State Department briefing paper for Secretary Baker, Secretary of State Baker, before he met with the Iraqi Undersecretary Nizar Hamdoun. And in that memo, one of the points that they made was that as part of its approach to the United States, Iraq has begun expanding its oil exports to the U.S. and giving favorable deals to U.S. oil companies. Now, that certainly raises a specter that there was something afoot here more than diplomacy, particularly when you look at the oil backgrounds of George Bush and James Baker, to name just two people. What we found in sort of reporting on and expanding that memo was that during the 1988, 89, and early 90 period, the Iraqis were giving, in fact, a very favorable price on crude oil to American importers. Whether that was, you know, a motivating factor behind this policy or not is still an open question, I'm afraid, Terry.
Secretary of State James Baker has emerged as one of the heroes of the Bush administration. He is the person who has organized the Middle East peace negotiations. He was recently brought in to head the president's campaign. And in the last presidential debate, in the first presidential debate, Bush said that if he's reelected, that Baker would become a kind of deputy vice president and would head up the new American economic policies. How does Baker emerge from this story?
Well, I think he emerges very badly, and I hope that if he does at some point become the domestic economy or czar in a new Bush administration, that he'll do better there than he did on the Iraq foreign policy. The president himself has admitted that this policy failed. Its chief architects were George Bush and his Secretary of State, James Baker. And we were talking earlier about how far we could track these intelligence warnings and how much did the president know. That remains uncertain. That matter's open to question. However, what is not open to question is that James Baker knew full well what Iraq was up to, and he still pushed hard to maintain this pro-Iraqi tilt in the face of intelligence warnings and advice otherwise from people within the State Department and outside the State Department.
Where does the story go next?
I'm not sure. I've run into problems with the editors in L.A. over this story because we've entered this sort of zone of fairness where it's hard to get the thing out on the front page if they view it as an attack on the president. And I had this story that was in the paper this morning, which I thought was a real important story to summarize what Bush knew. And it contained some pretty good new information, such as that cable. But it got put inside purposely because, you know, they didn't want us to be perceived as raising this issue. I think that CIA Justice Department dispute is going to play out in the next few weeks before the election because the Democrats on the Hill are pushing that issue very hard. I think this is David Boren doing his bit here for the Clinton campaign. I think Gonzalez is going to have more floor statements, but I think that most of the shoes have dropped at this point. You know, the big picture is out there. People can look at this policy and decide for themselves whether it was a good risk or a bad risk.
Douglas Franz, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure, as always. Thanks.
Douglas Franz is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He's been investigating the Iraqgate story for close to a year. We recorded our interview earlier today. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Remember the wolf in The Three Little Pigs? Well, turns out he wasn't so big and so bad, he was just misunderstood. We talk with John Sheska and Lane Smith about retelling some classic fairy tales. Their books include The True Story of The Three Little Pigs and The Stinky Cheese Man and Other Fairly Stupid Tales. Also, rock historian Ed Ward remembers the brains behind Scepter Records, the label that brought us the Shirelles, the Isley Brothers, and Dionne Warwick. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Tonight's vice presidential debate in Atlanta got off to a spirited start when Democratic vice presidential contender Al Gore, in his opening statement, referred to Vice President Dan Quayle's appearance 4 years ago with Senator Lloyd Benson.
I'll make you a deal this evening. If you don't try to compare George Bush to Harry Truman, I won't compare you to Jack Kennedy.
Then, in answer to a question about their qualifications for the job of vice president, Quayle said he has the experience.
I've been there, and I'll tell you one other thing that qualifies you for being president, and it's this, Hal. You got to stand up for what you believe in. And nobody has ever criticized me for not having strong beliefs.
An independent vice presidential candidate, James Stockdale, said he would work in a partnership if Ross Perot is elected.
I am sure that he would make me a partner in decisions, in making decisions about the way to handle health care, the way to get this economy back on its feet again.
Tonight's debate is being held at Georgia Tech in Atlanta. It continues at this hour. In Egypt, the death toll continues to rise from yesterday's major earthquake. While officials now place the number of dead at about 400, Egypt's Red Crescent Society is predicting that figure could double. Laurie Neff reports from Cairo.
Egyptian Prime Minister Atef Sidki says the report that 1,000 people had died or were missing due to yesterday's earthquake is completely inaccurate. That after the director of Egypt's Red Crescent Society said he expected the death toll alone to reach 700 or 800. The International Red Cross has issued an appeal for aid to the earthquake victims. The agency says it needs more than $1 million in funding. Quake registered 5.9 on the Richter scale. However, a tremor in Northern California 3 years ago measured 6.9, making it 10 times as strong, and it killed 67 people. Some officials say Egypt's high casualty count is partly due to Cairo's large number of rickety old buildings and poorly constructed new ones. For National Public Radio, I'm Laurie Neff in Cairo.
President Bush has signed a bill that allows 70,000 Chinese students to stay in the United States if conditions in China will not ensure their safe return there by the middle of next year. Because of concern about human rights in China, deportation of the Chinese students has been deferred. This new measure allows the U.S. Attorney General to grant the Chinese nationals resident status unless the president decides it's safe for them to return home by the middle of next year. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 27 points to close at 3,201.42 on volume of more than 184 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 10 to 7 in active trading. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, just hours before electrical power was to return to the capital, shelling knocked out power lines again. For the past 2 days, repair teams, along with UN peacekeeping troops, have worked to get power back to Sarajevo after 2 months without it. There's also a severe shortage of water after no running water for 3 weeks. As winter approaches, there is concern not only about food shortages, but lack of shelter as well. There's been no major fighting in Sarajevo in nearly 1 week, but sniping and small arms fire continues. In Russia, the nation's highest court has agreed to lift a travel ban on former President Gorbachev. Tim Hewell of the BBC reports from Moscow.
A spokeswoman for the Constitutional Court said Mr. Gorbachev would now be free to attend Willy Brandt's funeral at the weekend, and she added that she believed there were no longer any restrictions on the former Soviet leader travelling anywhere. The apparent removal of the travel ban follows widespread protests in the West over Mr. Gorbachev's treatment. Those protests have apparently convinced some Russian politicians that the sanctions taken against Mr. Gorbachev may have harmed the Russian government's image abroad. In any case, although Mr. Gorbachev has repeated several times that he's willing to meet the Constitutional Court judges in private to discuss the status of the Communist Party, he's still shown no signs of agreeing to appear before the court itself. In those circumstances, the authorities seem to have recognized that they've reached a legal dead end.
Tim Hewell reporting for the BBC. A senior Russian official says it will take at least 15 years to convert the nation's huge military complex and that Moscow will have to sell arms overseas to help pay for it. Officials say it will cost about $150 billion to convert some 70% of Russia's military-industrial complex to civilian use. Because of this expense, officials say it is useless to stop Russian military sales. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My two guests are carrying on the tradition of fractured fairy tales. Their new children's book, The Stinky Cheese Man and Other Fairly Stupid Tales, includes such stories as Chicken Licken, The Really Ugly Duckling, Cinderumpel Stiltskin, and Little Red Running Shorts. They spoof Westerns in their book The Good, the Bad, and the Goofy, and they take on King Arthur's court in The Knights of the Kitchen Table. John Sheska is the writer. Lane Smith is the illustrator. They first collaborated on an updating of The Three Little Pigs, which was described in the New York Times as a witty and innovative book. Now there's a cassette version of The Pigs, with writer John Sheska reading to music composed by Kurt Hoffman of the group The Ordinaires.
Everybody knows the story of The Three Little Pigs, or at least they think they do. But I'll let you in on a little secret. Nobody knows the real story because nobody has ever heard my side of the story. I'm the wolf, Alexander T. Wolf. You can call me Al. I don't know how this whole big bad wolf thing got started, but it's all wrong.
Okay, well, let's meet the author. John, what is the real story as you've told it?
Well, the real story is that it wasn't Al's fault. The poor guy just had a bad sneezing cold, blew down a few houses when he went to pick up a cup of sugar for his granny's birthday cake, and got framed by the media. It's kind of a sad tale, actually.
Lynn, I want to ask you about your drawing style. I mean, you have this combination of fantasy and super realism in your style, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I was obviously influenced by the MGM cartoons, you know, Tex Avery, and in you know, contemporary art and art history, I obviously go for the guys like Paul Klee and Miro and the more stylist people. But, I mean, I think what keeps it in check for me is it can be goofy and humorous, but the palette is fairly classic. I mean, it's a lot of sienna tones, a lot of dark, rich colors. So I think I could take something like what John's done, a text that's sophisticated, but it's still goofy, and it's the perfect marriage.
John, how did you start writing for children?
I originally came out here to New York to go to Columbia to the MFA program in writing, in fiction writing, and started out writing tortured short stories and novellas, not selling any of them. And then I just kind of stumbled into teaching. And I've taught elementary school for about the last 10 years here in New York. And it struck me about 5 years into it, after I just read a bunch of stuff and hung out with second graders, that my obvious audience was right in front of me. And so I took off a year and just wrote stuff.
Lane, had you been doing children's work at all?
Well, I did two books. I did a book called Halloween ABC, and then a wordless book, Flying Jake, and I had a little bit of problem with both of those. So,
in fact, Lane would like to read some of Flying Jake now if he could.
The first book, Halloween ABC, suffered a little bit of censorship and banning. I mean, it was being pulled off the shelves here and there because it depicted devils and fun little Halloween creatures.
Have you had any problems like that now with people wanting to take your books off the shelves?
Yeah, but I don't
just
think...
Just Maine has. I'm not a Satan worshiper.
No, I think I was a little surprised with Three Little Pigs. I thought we'd get some real crackpot letters because the wolf eats the pigs. I was prepared a little bit for that, but we really didn't get any.
Maybe we'll get that with the Stinky Cheese Man.
I hope so.
John, why don't you tell the story of the Stinky Cheese Man?
Ooh, it's pretty scary. Okay. Do you want me to, like, just read a little bit of it?
Sure.
Once upon a time, there was a little old woman and a little old man who lived together in a little old house. They were lonely, so the little old lady decided to make a man out of stinky cheese. She gave him a piece of bacon for a mouth and two olives for eyes and put him in the oven to cook. When she opened the oven to see if he was done, the smell knocked her back. "Phew!" she cried. "What is that terrible smell?" The stinky cheese man hopped out of the oven and ran out the door calling, "Run, run, run as fast as you can. You can't catch me. I'm the stinky cheese man." The little old lady and the little old man sniffed the air. I'm not really very hungry," said the little old man. "I'm not really all that lonely," said the little old lady. So they didn't chase the stinky cheese man. The stinky cheese man, meanwhile, ran and ran until he met a cow eating grass in the field. "Whoa! What's that awful smell?" said the cow. The stinky cheese man said, "I've run away from a little old lady and a little old man, and I can run away from you too, I can. Run, run, run as fast as you can. You can't catch me. I'm the stinky cheese man." The cow gave another sniff and said, "I'll bet you could give someone two or three stomach aches. I think I'll just eat weeds." So the cow didn't chase the stinky cheese man either. The stinky cheese man ran and ran until he met some kids playing outside school. "Gross," said a little girl. "What's that nasty smell?" "I've run away from a little old lady and a little old man and a cow, and I can run away from you too, I can. Run, run, run as fast as you can. You can't catch me. I'm the stinky cheese man." A little boy looked up, sniffed the air, and said, "If we catch him, our teacher will probably make us eat him. Let's get out of here." So the kids didn't chase the stinky cheese man either. By and by, the stinky cheese man came to a river with no bridge. "How will I ever cross this river? It's too big to jump, and if I try to swim across, I'll probably fall apart," said you-know-who. Just then, the sly fox, who shows up in a lot of stories like these, poked his head out of the bushes. "Why, just hop on my back and I'll carry you across, Stinky Cheese Man." "How do I know you won't eat me?" "Trust me," said the fox. So the Stinky Cheese Man hopped on the fox's back. The fox swam to the middle of the river and said, "Oh, man, what is that funky smell?" The fox coughed, gagged, and sneezed, and the stinky cheese man flew off his back and into the river where he fell apart. Now, the end.
What would Aesop make of this?
I think he'd like it.
That's so sad.
Actually, I think it's nice that a lot of teachers have discovered these twisted tales and sort of used them as a springboard to go back and reread old fairy tales, Aesop's fables.
I'm sure they don't read your tales and say, "Now, boys and girls, what is the moral of this fable?"
Actually, I hope they don't, or maybe the really ugly duckling might get us in trouble in some counties.
Yeah, well, you want to explain the twist you've put on the ugly duckling?
Well, yeah, it's not exactly like the ugly duckling, except it's the really ugly duckling, and it turns out he grows up to be just a really ugly duck. And that's, right. That was kind of the reaction of my son's kindergarten class. Dead silence for a good minute there. That's when I decided to put the end on the end of all the stories.
It is over.
Yes. Just a little clue. You can clap now.
My guests are writer John Sheska and illustrator Lane Smith. Their latest book is called The Stinky Cheese Man and Other Fairly Stupid Tales. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are John Sheska and Lane Smith, who collaborate on children's books. Lane, how did you decide to draw the Stinky Cheese Man?
I actually went through several variations. I think the starting point was obviously the gingerbread man, but I sketching one day, I found that his head would be great to do as a giant wheel of cheese. And all the great cartoon characters like... Gumby had the little bump on his head, and Charlie Brown's got the weird little squiggle. So with this character, we put a wedge of cheese taken out of the side of his head.
Oh, you're trying to say this is some kind of classic illustrator trick? This is just demonic.
It is.
It's nice, though. The wedge reappears at the very last page of the book.
Just in case.
Well, you don't have mold growing on his head.
Well, I wouldn't be so sure about
that. Is that little green
it's
mold there?
It's kind of greenish yeah. there, yeah.
Okay.
Say, my work's pretty textured anyway, so mm-hmm. looks pretty moldy.
I read about you that you were, for a while, a sweeper at Disneyland.
Who told you that?
did you get this job hoping that you'd meet, like, top animators and have an in, or were you just making money sweeping?
Well, that's what they promised me. They yeah. said if you clean up around the teacups, you'll eventually probably meet one of Walt's nephews, but unless they got sick, I never did. Well, we live fairly close to there, so it just seemed like a natural thing. I think Orange County is secretly run by the Disney organization anyway, so I think when you're of a certain age, you're drafted to work at one of the theme parks. And being a custodial host.
Oh, I thought you were a sweeper, Lane.
I was a custodial host.
Oh.
That was actually the perfect job because we had the best unions and got paid the most and did the least amount of work, I think.
If you were a custodial host, I'm sure you had a uniform.
I had a Ooh. White uniform with a little badge with Mickey's picture on it.
What was it like for you? I mean, having this real visual sense to report every day to a theme park.
I don't know. I kind of like the kitsch of it all. I mean, I never took anything there seriously, and I meet a lot of people who are just completely offended by the idea of a theme park. But I always thought it was kind of fun. I mean, my work certainly hasn't suffered. I think I take all that sort of plastic mentality and put it into my work without just parroting the stuff back. I mean, I think that's the real fear. I think most of the people that go to work, for instance, at the animation studios of Disney are little robots, and they all draw the same and they paint the same. And but I was able to sweep out the Haunted Mansion at night and just see what a bizarre, tacky, fun, kitschy place it was.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you both a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Writer John Sheska and illustrator Lane Smith. Their latest book is called The Stinky Cheese Man and Other Fairly Stupid Tales. There's also a cassette version of their true story of the Three Little Pigs. Thank you. is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have on the earthquake in Cairo?
We have a report from the scene as well as a discussion of seismic activity in the Near East and what those sorts of fault lines and what the history is in that part of the world. We will talk to the man who won the Nobel Prize in economics. He says, Terry, that economics should be applied to daily life, that an economic value can be placed on love and marriage. We have a stump speech from Governor Clinton. This one is on foreign policy and a discussion of how the Electoral College stands at this moment and a conversation with the producer of a new movie, Storyville.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Scepter Records was started in an unlikely way by a housewife from New Jersey. Using a group of her daughter's high school friends for her first recording, she built Scepter Records into a power to be reckoned with in just a few years. Over 60 singles recorded for Scepter were recently compiled on a box set. Our rock historian, Ed Ward, has the story of Scepter Records.
There's no reason on earth why Scepter Records should have been a success. It came onto the scene at a time when the day of the independent record label was almost over. It was run by a middle-aged Jewish housewife from New Jersey with no experience, and its first record was a flop. But the Scepter Records story is one of pure dumb luck and a shrewd ear for talent, both the property of Mrs. Florence Greenberg. Scepter started in 1958 when Mary Jane Greenberg brought a group of her friends at Passaic High School to her mother's attention. They sang so well, all they really needed was a break and a new name. Mrs. Greenberg changed the Pequellos to the Shirelles and recorded I Met Him on a Sunday for her Tiara label. Decca quickly bought the rights to the record and had sort of a semi-hit with it, then gave the rights to the group back to Mrs. Greenberg, telling her they were a one-shot group. She disagreed, so she rented some space in a Manhattan office building, hung the name Scepter Records on the door, and, with her blind son Stanley co-producing, cut another Shirelles record.
This is dedicated to the one I love. While I'm far away from you, my baby, I know it's hard for you, my baby, because it's hard for me, my baby, and the darkest hour is just before dawn.
Dedicated to the One I Love scraped the bottom of the charts and died, but Mrs. Greenberg was learning. She hired a legendary promotion man, Wally Roker, to help promote her records, and one day he introduced her to Luther Dixon, a young arranger and producer who had put Scepter on the map. Dixon was pure gold. First, he took on the Shirelles.
Tonight you're mine.
One night at the Apollo Theater in Harlem, Dixon heard Chuck Jackson and brought him in, using the same arranger he'd used with the Shirelles, Carole King.
I still love you, just like I did before. But before you smile and walk through the door, darling, I don't wanna cry. No, darling, no more.
And then a group from New Jersey that had been around forever but hadn't had a hit yet. By the time 1962 was over, Scepter was awash in hit records. It had a subsidiary label called Wand that was doing just as well, and young songwriters like Burt Bacharach and Hal David were coming to them with material.
I'm so used to doing everything with you, planning everything for two, and now that we're through, I just don't know what to do with my time.
Tommy Hunt didn't have a hit with that one, so they came back with another on a demo record. Mrs. Greenberg didn't have much use for the song, Make It Easy on Yourself, but she flipped for the girl who was singing it, a former gospel singer who was doing backup singing with her sister and cousin. So Bacharach and David produced a record with her. Dionne Warwick was the harbinger of the future for Scepter Records, and in many ways, a perfect artist for the Kennedy Johnson era, a black artist edging the pop mainstream. But the money to pay for those increasingly expensive recording sessions came from an inexpensive leased record from Washington State, which went on to sell 20 million copies worldwide. Scepter was about to turn a very important corner, and I'll get to that in part two.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle, part two of his Scepter record story tomorrow. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Joan Tui, with Sue Spolin and Sue Weinstein, research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Any day now, I will hear you say goodbye, my love, and you'll be on your way. Then, my wild, beautiful bird, you will have flown. Oh, any day now, I'll be all alone.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how the U.S. squandered its lead in technology and what that means to our national security and economic health. We'll talk with Martin Tolchin, co-author of Selling Our Security. Also, performing in a live sitcom, we talk with actor Rocky Carroll from the TV series Rock. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.